Hi there, and thanks for joining Chicago Tonight Black Voices. I'm Brandis Friedman. Coming up, an ambitious proposal for early childhood education in Illinois. We talk about how expanded preschool can benefit small kids. Revisiting one of Chicago's earliest child education programs in a new documentary called Tomorrow's Hope. Social impact giving. What is it, and how is it shaking up the world of philanthropy?
I'm Angelito, and coming up tonight, I'm having a permanent conversation with tattoo artist Ryan Henry.
Wait till you see that one. All that coming up. But our first story tonight, the state's littlest learners might be getting more funding. What that could mean for families, right after this.
Chicago Tonight, Black Voices, is made possible in part by Fifth Third Bank and by the support of these donors.
At Fifth Third, we believe when diverse voices are heard and empowered, communities are made stronger, lives are made better, and the future holds greater promise for all. That's why we're proud to support Chicago Tonight Black Voices. Together, we can make a difference. Together, we can drive change.
For the most part, free public education in the U.S. starts at the kindergarten level, when children are around age 5. But research is revealing just how critical the first few years are to long-term outcomes. Governor J.B. Pritzker announces he's looking to expand access to education for preschool kids in Illinois. It's part of his proposed Smart Start program. Under Pritzker's 2024 fiscal plan, an additional 5,000 kids will be able to go to preschool next year, eventually adding a total of 20,000 slots. The plan would also add money to increase wages for early education providers. Here's some of what the governor had to say when unveiling the proposal.
Smart Start is comprised of four elements: pre-K, childcare, early intervention, and home visiting. It also makes our existing programs more equitable, giving moderate income families greater access to quality programs and investing in an early childhood workforce made up largely of women and people of color. Smart Start Pre-K is a four-year plan that will allow us to give access to preschool to every 3- and 4-year-old in Illinois.
And joining us to talk about what this proposal could mean for early childhood education in Illinois are April Janney, CEO of Illinois Action for Children, Megan Goen, a postdoctoral researcher at the Erickson Institute, and Sonia Crum-Knight, Chief Programs and Impact Officer at the Carol Robertson Center for Learning. Thanks to all three of you for joining us. Welcome to Chicago Tonight, Black Voices. April Janney, starting with you, please, how would you say Illinois compares to other states in their approach to funding early education?
I think Illinois overall has been out there in front. We've been focused on the littlest learners for a long time and investing in that area. And I think we have started out investing more over these years. And so I think we're out ahead.
Okay. Sonia Crum-Knight, what are some of the barriers to early education services or access that, you know, families experience, like the ones that you all serve at Carol Robertson Centers for Learning?
Yeah, so I think the primary barrier, to access is having the resources to pay for high-quality early learning. Moderate-income working families cannot afford the market value that is often charged for high-quality early care and education. So often families are taxed to pay, or usually women have to leave the workforce.
Megan Goen, the proposal includes improving wages for early education providers. What kind of a difference might that make?
I think that that's going to be extremely impactful. I actually started my career as a pre-K teacher assistant, and so then making the transition later on to get that early childhood teacher credential, it was to support my young children. They were 4 months and 2 years old at the time. So I think this investment in our workforce to really make sure that they are well compensated is going to only increase that push towards quality.
And Megan, Erickson's also launched a new teacher training program that includes early education. Tell us briefly about what that does and what it is.
Sure. So Erickson, we're kind of following in our legacy of really being responsive to the needs of communities. And so we've reimagined our early childhood teacher education program, where it is a triple endorsement. So our graduates will not only leave with a master's degree in early childhood education, but also three endorsements. So an early childhood endorsement, an endorsement for ESL and bilingual education, and also a special educational endorsement. So really being able to support educators to provide those culturally sustainable and inclusive learning environments.
I see the two of you nodding your heads. April, I'm going to ask you the same question about improving wages for the early ed providers and what kind of a difference that might make for them.
I think it's a fantastic opportunity to make sure we can retain those employees with the amount that he's putting into the budget. So hopefully retain and diversify our field, because even though the majority of them are women, the majority of those women are Black women. And so having them to push their training and get better education is a cost to them, but then we're not paying them as professionals.
Sonia, tell us a little bit about, you know, what you all experience. What are the challenges with, you know, obviously hiring the qualified staff that you need, because watching a bunch of small children and helping them learn is no small task.
Yeah, I mean, what's so exciting about what the governor is doing is it's really turning those old notions of childminding on its head, right? This is work that is historically not valued because it's done by women of color. And so when you talk about early learning being a career, you know, that includes educational attainment that needs to be commensurate with earnings. So this creates, and what you just described, right, Megan, creates an opportunity not only to grow an educational attainment, but also to increase earnings, and that uplifts communities and families. So we're really excited about that.
And on a programming level, Sonia, how could the governor's proposal improve the services that you all provide at Carol Robertson?
Yeah, so if we think about what it takes for high quality early care and education, that teacher training and the relationship with the child is central. So when you increase the wages, right, and you build that workforce through higher educational attainment, you are ensuring high quality outcomes for children. That is the sauce is not so secret, but it's there.
April, who are the children who stand to benefit the most from this kind of increased early learning opportunity?
I think one area that we're looking at are those children that are birthed to infants and toddlers, more focused on them. But through the Preschool for All improvement and money that he's offering, those 3 and 4 year olds getting free child care for all of those would be good. And that's some of those 5,000 children that you were speaking of, with the focus too on the training for the infant and toddlers.
And are we talking about, you know, mostly families who might access, for example, Carol Robertson Center, or like who are the families that need the support versus, you know, those who might be paying, like you mentioned, Sonia, market rate for childcare, which can be expensive.
Very expensive when you think about the majority of, we talked about this, families paying sometimes 30% of their income towards childcare. That's like sending someone to college, and they're in preschool or in early education programs. But a lot of those families are the families also that have just-in-time jobs or are working off hours and may not be getting all their hours all the time. So it's really challenging for them to plan and budget. And sometimes they have to make decisions. Do I work? Do I stay home? Do I take that raise? Or do I not take that raise because now I can't get child care, especially if they're trying to get covered by the child care assistance program.
Right. Of course, right? Like the subsidy, it has an income cap.
So they make that decision. Do I take the raise or do I keep my child care?
Which would disqualify me for the subsidized child care support. Megan, should Smart Start be enacted, what do you think would be the metrics for success?
I think one of the metrics that we have to think about, how are we contextualizing equity? We have used equity as a buzzword, but how are we really measuring equity? So I think the investment in quality programs, and so the money that is earmarked for providers to really build up their own infrastructure, right? The money that we know is built into supporting the workforce. But I think thinking of how are we kind of dismantling some of the inequitable systems that we've seen, we said earlier that we're now seeing where this investment is putting that financial, you know, that push into the system, right? We've heard it. Everyone cares about young children and families, but now we see it in dollars.
Sonia, How has thinking evolved over providing childcare for this age group, birth to 5 years old, versus, excuse me, providing education versus just providing childcare? How's our thinking sort of changed from that?
Yeah, so, you know, the sort of trajectory of early childhood education study, like what we know about what's good for children, rests on years and years, right? Centuries of research and development. And what we've learned about brain development in the last 30 years tells us that, you know, what's happening between 0 and 3 is critical. Right? So we have to move away from those custodial models of care. And we've had a system, right, that has basically forced wonderful practitioners to choose between serving in their communities or getting a job at Amazon or Walmart, right? Because we haven't looked at early education as education. Right? We've looked at it as childminding, as, you know, something you do, too bad you have to work, bring your children here, rather than enrichment and education. I think one of the things that's really going to tell the story about this is we know how our children are entering, you know, especially the communities that the Carol Robertson Center for Learning serves. We're very much focused on kindergarten readiness, right? Because we know that that is what the lever for school success. So now that we're looking at the workforce, we're linking that to quality, you know, 5 to 10 years, we'll see those outcomes in kindergarten readiness that we talk about.
April, Janet, we've got a little less than a minute left. Do you anticipate any pushback? Because obviously everyone supports early learning and making sure that young people learn, but not everybody supports paying for it.
That's what I was going to say. The pushback would be related to the price tag and how do we do it? What are the mechanisms we use? How do we make sure it stays equitable and fairly distributed in the communities that need it the most and to the children that need it the most? I think it's going to be the price tag.
It's going to be, isn't it always? something that I hope the three of us, or the four of us, can continue talking about, because I know there's some questions about how this whole thing gets rolled out. So I look forward to continuing that discussion with the three of you. For now, thanks to April Janney, Sonia Crum-Knight, and Megan Goen for joining us.
Thank you.
The Robert Taylor Homes in Bronzeville were at one point the largest public housing development in the country. As many as 27,000 families lived in the buildings, which were demolished in the late 90s. But even amid the chaos that characterized the home's last decades, an ambitious early education program helped the children who lived there flourish. The new documentary, Tomorrow's Hope, tells the story of that program, now known as EduCare, through interviews with some of EduCare's first students and program originators.
And we decided that we're going to bring the services where the people are. We planted ourselves inside the same buildings where the families live. We were in Robert Taylor Homes, and at that time, it was the largest public housing development in the country.
The Housing Authority decided that public housing, Robert Taylor Home, would be torn down. And what happened was it ignited, besides being a disruption to the children and families, and the services, it ignited, as they tore down the buildings, a crime and drug war. Nobody seemed to care about what was happening to this community, in which all of the resources that one would naturally expect in a community to be available were being shut down. I think we were the last organization standing through the destruction of the buildings, and we reemerged, as I say, rose up out of the ashes on the other side of the building and created EduCare School. And I think when you look at Tomorrow's Hope, you'll see the resilience and the capacity of children and families in such dire situations to overcome through participating in educational experience with a staff of teachers and others that said to them, you matter. I don't care what's going on in this community. You matter, and we're going to work with you. We're not going to give up on you.
Tomorrow's Hope will be released digitally on March 21st, and you can find more about that on our website. Back with more Chicago Tonight Black Voices right after this. The numbers don't lie. Charitable donors can be risk averse, But there's a locally based foundation working to make philanthropy more equitable, diverse, and inclusive, to the tune of $1 billion in grants so far. Joining us now is Cecilia Conrad, the CEO of Lever for Change, an offshoot of the MacArthur Foundation that connects donors to once overlooked social change organizations. Cecilia, thank you for joining us. I think you might be on mute, but I will ask a question while you remedy that. So you've described traditional philanthropic giving as timid. What do you mean by that?
Well, as you mentioned in your intro, philanthropists sometimes are quite risk-averse about their giving, and that leads them to focus their attention on organizations they know. Sometimes that means it's their alma mater, on organizations that are well-known, and on giving small grants. 50,000 is the average grant size over 18 months. We're trying to shake that up.
So tell me a little bit more then about how the model of Lever for Change is different.
Well, the first thing is that we have an open call process for organizations to participate in our challenges. We work with an individual donor who says, for example, they might have an interest in a stronger democracy or in improving racial equity. We then design a process where organizations can apply. They have a transparent criteria that will be used to evaluate the projects. We convene a panel of external experts to score those projects. And then the organizations get the feedback through that process as well. So we try to create a process that will be value added for the organizations. The donor then will choose one of the projects to be the grant recipient. We encourage the donors to do large multi-year grants. For most of our competitions, the minimum grant is a $10 million award over 5 years. And that gives organizations a chance to really do the work as opposed to having to go out every year and figure out how are they going to fund the next year. And if you have that, then you can plan. You can really try to move the needle on some of the pressing problems that we face.
So $10 million over 5 years from what you said was an average of $50,000 over 18 months is a significant difference. How does, you know, making this connection and boosting pretty significantly the donation amount, how does that make philanthropy more equitable?
Well, the first part is the fact that we are open instead of an invitation-only process. Most philanthropy is, most of the foundations that are out there and individual donors only accept applications by invitation. You can't just apply. And what that means is that if you're not part of a network that has a connection to a program officer or to a very wealthy person, it may be difficult for your great idea to get seen. And that tends to disadvantage grassroots organizations, organizations with proximate leadership, organizations led by people of color. So with this open process, we're able to identify and uncover ideas that might otherwise be overlooked.
So locally, you've supported Communities United, as well as the nonprofit journalism organization City Bureau. Tell us a little bit about why these two groups were selected. Why are they good examples?
Yes. Well, all right. So first, we'll start with Communities United. Communities United was one of the awardees from the Kellogg Racial Equity 2030 Challenge. This was sponsored by the Kellogg Foundation. It was a global call for projects that promise to help to reduce racial inequity, to narrow gaps. And the concept of race was interpreted so that it could be global. So it's a big statement to say that they were one of the recipients, our own local organization here in Chicago. And this is a youth-led group that is focused on addressing some of the mental health issues that young people are confronting today through community healing, through engaging the young people in social action and leadership training, and using that as a way of creating a healing process for those young people. It's a really exciting project. I think it's one that's going to get picked up and replicated in other cities and other communities. They're working in conjunction with the Lurie Children's Hospital. And that is you know, how they ended up rising to the top in this global challenge that the Kellogg Foundation ran. And then the City Bureau and Documenters Network is another one that's from a different challenge, Stronger Democracy. And it was also a recipient of a $10 million award. And this is expanding a model that was developed here in Chicago of sending people to do minutes from local commission meetings to help fill the gap in local news coverage, but also it's a civic engagement project because people are starting to learn how government works. And the idea will be to transfer that to other cities.
Cecilia, even philanthropists as rich as Jeff Bezos have said that he has trouble giving away his money effectively and efficiently. What are some of the challenges for big donors like that when figuring out how and where to give?
Well, I think the first is that in many cases, these are people who are still making their money from running their businesses, and they are sometimes allergic to setting up their own infrastructure, to hire program officers, to set up a MacArthur Foundation, essentially. They may not be willing to do that. We can help to fill that void. That's part of what we do. We provide the infrastructure. We help source the projects and get them in front of them. They also, we talked earlier about being a bit risk averse. We've developed a very rigorous evaluation mechanism so that a donor can feel very confident about making a big grant. And then the other thing we're doing that kind of helps on this way is that whenever we run one of these challenges, one of these open calls, we're going to turn up more good ideas than an individual donor is going to want to fund. We work to get those ideas in front of other funders. So when you talked about the billion that we have facilitated in our first 4 years, about half of that has not been from the original donor, but from other donors that we've brought on board and said, hey, we've got great projects pre-vetted from organizations you might not have found on your own. And it's working.
It's making philanthropy very exciting. Cecilia Conrad, CEO of Lever for Change, thank you so much for joining us.
Thank you.
Up next, Angelito getting inked. Stay tuned.
A local artist has been receiving national recognition for his artwork over the last decade. Now, he uses a common artist tool, ink. His canvas, skin. Now, we recently visited his shop in Pilsen for an up-close look at the art of tattooing.
I began to grow and expand my brand and become notable and respected in the industry. I was able to create certain private studios and then going into owning the shop, you know, the ups and downs of being a business owner. And then now I'm here at this shop for about 4 years now.
It was about halfway through his 14-year career that Ryan Henry's recognition went national when he and his artwork were showcased on a new VH1 show, Black Ink Crew Chicago.
The last 15 years has been so much more socially accepted in pretty much every industry for what it wasn't 20 years ago. Now it's becoming more accepted now with a newer generation, or with people just being more understanding that it's artistic expression.
I think we finished. Check it out.
Dun, dun, dun.
Wow. So I did a thing, and it was a pretty big thing.
Brand new.
I got my first tattoo.
I don't like it unless
brand new.
It definitely didn't hurt at all. Okay, that's a lie. Definitely hurt a little bit.
I don't like it unless it's
brand new.
Okay, I'm lying. It totally hurt.
Tattooing is a whole entire culture of people who pretty much are just expressing themselves. We have an entire culture of artists, but you also have, going along with that, an entire culture of art connoisseurs and art collectors.
That's why Henry works with community partners to help tattoo lovers explore the craft as a mainstream art form.
They might not know art, but they know what they would like. The same way you would buy a painting and put it on your wall would be the same way you would display something that you like on your body if you are that type of art collector. And that's by the hundreds of millions around the world.
And once you enter, you gotta be committed.
wasn't until after I finished my first and only tattoo that I better understood the desire for the art form.
Let me see your phone.
Oh my gosh, I just want to reiterate, it did not hurt at all. Now, some of those community partners that Ryan Henry works with include Red Bull, who recently had their own doodle art contest. That's a national contest described to be perfect for tattoo artists. Visit our website for more information on how you can get a tattoo at 9 Mag in Pilsen. Now, Brandis, back to you.
Didn't hurt, huh? Way to go all in on the story, Angel. That is our show for this weekend. Be sure to check out our website, WTTW.com/news, for the very latest from WTTW News. And if you're watching us on Saturday night, know that you can also catch Black Voices and Latino Voices on Sundays beginning at 10 p.m. And join me and Paris Schutz next week at 10 on Chicago Tonight. And we leave you tonight with Red Bull's Doodle Art Workshop featuring tattoo artist Ryan Henry. Now, for all of us here at Chicago Tonight, Black Voices, I'm Brandis Friedman. Thanks for sharing part of your weekend with us. Have a good night.
Closed captioning is made possible by Robert A. Clifford and Clifford Law Offices, a Chicago personal injury and wrongful death firm that's proud to serve its community through pro bono legal services.